Hebrews chapter 11. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good report. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. What it means, very simply, substance is very close to the Greek word that it's translated from, hypostasis, which means a setting under, substance, that which stands under. What we hope for is set upon our faith. Our faith is what holds our hope up. It's what is underpinning our hope. We believe in the resurrection. What holds us up in that hope is our faith that it's going to happen. What is faith? I mean, what does the word mean? Because there's a lot of, you know, have faith, believe in yourself. Faith is, the word means, at least the Greek word, means persuasion. It is that quality that we possess when we are persuaded of something, when we believe something. When we have that, when we become, when in our minds we accept it as being true, that acceptance, that persuasion is called faith. We believe in the resurrection. We expect it to come. It is our hope. Therefore, our faith is the persuasion of that thing actually coming into reality. So it becomes to us the proof. The only thing solid, you should say, or we could say, of that actually happening. It's all we have to, you know, that our belief, that's what we have for what is coming. And this is what God has chosen that pleases Him, that we should have faith in that which we do not yet see. And that which, and some people say, well, you know, some people misunderstand this and say, as Paul says, you know, if you already see it, why do you yet hope for it? But still, it's like people have a lot of faith in the law of gravity, even though they observe it. And some people say, well, that's not faith. Well, in a certain sense, it's not faith only. It's faith, because I get these arguments. And the reason I'm going into this is because people out there will argue that faith is not based on proof. That it is only based on nothing except a promise of something to come. But that's not entirely true. Because our faith in the resurrection is not based on merely God saying, "Us, you will be raised," or just out of the bold blue, we believe we will be raised. Of our belief in ourself or our belief in belief. We are believing in God to raise us from the dead. We are believing in God to raise us from the dead as He rose Christ from the dead. If you believe that God raised Jesus from the dead, you should also believe that He will raise your body from the dead. So our faith is based on, and then people would argue, well, there's no proof for those things. But that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is something can be proved, and you still place your faith in it. We know that whenever things go up, they come down. I know that if I drop something, it's going to fall to the earth. We call it the law of gravity. We have faith in it, though. How do you? Because we have faith and we expect that it's going to continue operating as it has operated. See, faith is the substance of something we don't see. Gravity could cease to operate tomorrow. Now you say, well, that's impossible. Well, how do you know it's impossible? Well, because it's always operated that way. But how do you know that it's impossible for it to suddenly cease operating? And any person who, and only, you know, a person of intelligence has to understand, please understand, that we don't really know for sure. You have to say, well, of course, anything can happen. Because to assume otherwise is not logical. It's not logical to assume that gravity will continue operating. Though it's not entirely unsound, right, to expect that, but we expect gravity to continue operating because of faith. When I raise something into the air to drop it, I believe it is going to fall to the ground. That moment when before I drop it, where I think it will fall, before it actually falls, I haven't seen it fall, but I believe it will fall. That's faith. Now, of course, you could say, well, I know it's going to fall. Well, you don't really know it's going to fall until you let go. Well, I do, you know, you can be stubborn, but this is the true. This is the true logical way of thinking. You really don't know if the object is going to fall. You don't. You could do it a million times in a row, and the million and first time, it might just levitate there. Well, that's crazy. Of course it's crazy, but that's philosophy. The point of this is that that moment, before it actually happens, before I see it happen, it is faith operating. And it's based on, my faith is based on, well, a million other times I dropped it and it fell. So I believe it's going to fall again. You say, well, it's based on proof. Well, no, it's not based on proof till I actually drop it. Because I don't know if this is the time when it's going to levitate. And that is absolutely true. It's based on faith until you actually see it. Past proofs are not proofs that it's going to be again. Though you come, it is becomes 99.99999999999% likely. The likelihood is extremely high that it's going to fall again. Why? Because I have millions of examples of things, and probably billions and trillions of examples of things falling when we drop them. The probability is extremely high that it's going to fall, but it's not proven that it's going to fall. And I use that analogy so that you would understand how faith is. It is not based on nothing. It is based on certain things that we take to be facts. Certain things, like I'll use the resurrection again. A lot of people don't believe in the accounts of the resurrection, right? I do. Now, they could say, well, you're accepting that based on faith. And I say, well, I'm accepting their account. You know, a lot of people believe things about the earth and about science that they themselves haven't tested, but they believe the men who say they have tested it and that they have confirmed scientifically the results of their tests. So people accept these things as facts. No one was, there are many news stories reported for which only one reporter was on the scene and other people were not there. I watched a movie about a stoning of a woman, and a single reporter came to a village, and he received one person's testimony, published it. It became a movie down the road. It was the stoning of Soraya M. And you think about that. And everyone, when you watch it, you believe it's pretty true, right? I mean, we believe the basic facts. I mean, we know, like, when you see the movie, that it's a dramatization. But we still believe she was stoned to death, that someone was stoned to death there. And they had a photograph of her when she was young, only one surviving photograph. Well, it's the same thing with Christ. People were there and saw it, and they reported it to us. Now, whether or not we choose to believe and accept their testimony, we cannot deny the fact that the testimony exists. Meaning, if I come to you and say, I dropped a quarter, and instead of falling to the ground, it levitated. Now, I have proof. Because I'm not lying. I saw the quarter levitate. I'm speaking hypothetically. You know, I tried to drop a quarter to the ground, an object, whatever. I was holding a quarter before. I tried to drop an object to the ground, and it levitated. It didn't fall. Now, you, as a person who's skeptical, probably think, he's probably lying, because that's extremely unlikely. And that would be a reasonable thing to believe. It is reasonable. But then let's say you know me really well and you think, Paul would not make something like that up. You know what I mean? If you know me enough or think you know me enough to trust my word, you might take my account as proof. And that is how some people look at the New Testament and the accounts of those who wrote it. That we believe their account. We believe their evidence. We didn't actually see the resurrection, but they did. They saw the resurrection. But that doesn't mean that faith was negated. Because they still had faith that God would raise up their own bodies as they had raised up Jesus' body. So they had that evidence on which to build the hope. Because faith is faith based on evidence. There is very little you can have faith in based on no evidence. That's what people always tell me. Oh, your religion is based on no evidence, no scientific evidence. You know, and that's what they say. And I say, those kind of statements come from a lack of understanding of what evidence is and different kinds of evidence. What they're really saying is, I don't accept the evidence that you accept. I find your evidence unacceptable. The things you take as true, I'm skeptical of. I'm skeptical of the account of your apostles. I'm skeptical of the writings of the New Testament. But based on those writings, if you accept them, if you accept the account of the people as being true and faithful, then you do have evidence to believe in the resurrection. And you have evidence to believe in your resurrection, though it is only by faith that you can believe that you are going to be raised from the dead. Because you haven't seen it yet. So faith, your persuasion, which comes out of all these other facts, is the what holds up the substance, the underpinning of what we are expecting to happen. And if that seems like a bit of a long-winded example, I think it's important. I really do. Because a lot of times, you will hear these are. If you're a believer, you're going to run into people who say your belief is based not on evidence. And though what I've done is just a long-winded thing, I think that maybe if you can understand it in a deep way, that perhaps you might be able to make it easier for other people to understand your perspective. And that is the way it is with many things. You know, I've been accused of rambling and going in major digressions, but this is on the same subject. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. I would say everyone has faith. Atheists have faith. They have faith in the law, in the laws which they believe operate continually. They have faith, you know, they believe that gravity is going to work tomorrow, though they have not seen gravity working tomorrow. You know, we believe the earth will still be here tomorrow, though we have not seen the earth here tomorrow yet. So everyone has to operate on faith from one degree to the other. You know, juries operate on faith. Do you believe this man is guilty or not guilty? They don't actually know if he was guilty. They give their verdict based on the evidence they've seen of something they have not seen. And their persuasion is the support of their verdict. The fact that the evidence was persuasive enough to cause them to believe he's guilty. He's not guilty. You know, the persuasive, you know, that has to do with the persuasion, the quality of persuasion within the person. That is what faith is. How deep is your faith? How strong is your faith? Verse 2, for by it the elders obtained a good report. The elders, meaning he's going to go through all these people in the Old Testament, who obtained a good report of God, meaning God approved of them because of their faith. Verse 3, through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. It's very simple that the universe sprang from things which are not here now. According to the Bible, it came from God speaking it into existence. But even in science, you know, they look back and back with their super colliders to try to find out where was this all? You know, what was the universe like at 1 second from the Big Bang, as they call it? What was the universe like at this particular thing? You know, they try to get particles to move faster and faster and faster and faster, and to collide them at greater speeds and so on and so forth. They try to run particles at each other to try to create denser and denser materials and other things. You know, I don't pretend to at all be any sort of expert on any of those things. And I don't intend to talk to you like I know a lot about it. But there is more, you know, like they talk about dark matter, right? Things that do not appear. The things which appear, which we see, are made of things which do not appear. You know, everything as we see it is held together by things that are not seen. It is made by things, of things, not of things which appear. Verse 4. By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it, being dead, yet speaketh. God, you know, it says, the blood of thy brother Abel crieth to me to the ground, from the ground. That's what God said to Cain concerning his brother's murder. Abel offered his offering by faith. He offered a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. And there are a lot of ways in which people look at that, you know, because Abel, he offered an animal and shed its blood. And Cain brought an offering of the produce of the ground. Now, if you know anything about the Old Testament, the offerings of blood always had to do with sin. And offerings of grain had to do with, like, offerings of peace and offerings of, you know, they would offer their grain as a tribute and so on and so forth. So Cain was bringing an offering of tribute to God, almost one of, you know, of giving up something, but not giving up anything personally. And Cain was wroth when his offering was not accepted. And God said, you know, if you do well, will you not be accepted? But if you don't do well, sin lies at the door. See, Cain did not offer a sin offering. He offered some sort of peace offering, or some other kind of offering, an offering, as it says. Whereas Abel offered an offering in order that he felt was consummate with the gravity of his relationship with God, that he needed to offer something with blood. And today we have I really think that the idea of blood sacrifice to us is repulsive. I know it is to me, because I've actually killed an animal and eaten it, and I didn't particularly find the experience enjoyable. That's how far removed in this modern world many of us are from the things we consume and the death we bring about. I certainly don't feel guilty about it. But he obtained witness from God that he was righteous, the righteous blood of Abel. You know, though he offered an offering for sin, or it doesn't say that, but we kind of assume that, or Abel had a sin nature like you and I. He obtained the knowledge of good and evil. But God, by his grace, could pardon him and see him as righteous. Just like he did the other fathers. Because they were not sin-free. They would have inherited the sinful nature, but God declared Abel righteous. He gave an offering, he was righteous, and Cain slew him. And a lot of times that is compared to Christ, how the right Christ, you know, the Christ was the seed given instead of Abel, the righteous seed which would deliver mankind from their sins. By it, by what? By the witness of God that he obtained. By the excellent sacrifice, his gifts. You know, God testified of his gifts, that the gifts that Abel brought were acceptable to God. And so by it, he obtained, he spoke from the dead, in spirit. Again, his blood cried out from the ground. He didn't say, Cain, why is Abel here at my throne? I was sitting up on my throne, and suddenly, who should walk up but the ghost of Abel? I said, Abel, what are you doing here? And he says, my brother Cain slew me. And then God goes down, what hast thou done? No. But rather, you know, where is your brother Cain? Am I my brother's keeper? No. Abel cried from the ground. Because that is where his blood was spilled. The life is in the blood. Yes, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. But And everything God said in that, you know, where is your brother? Like he didn't know. It is for the benefit of the one and for the perspective of the one to whom he is speaking. Verse 5. By faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death. It was not found because God had translated him. For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. So we see, Enoch was translated. That word is metatithemi, which means to transfer or transport. He was transported that he should not see death. Now, some people think that means he never died. You know, and Enoch was not because the Lord took him. He was translated. But it also says in the scriptures, and there's several ways of looking at this, and I have to cover it because it was one of those verses that people might say, see, Paul, you say, and it's not that I say, it's that the Gospel of John says, no man hath ascended into heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man, which is in heaven. So there is no man in heaven who has ascended there other than Christ. So what about Enoch? What about Elijah? I know people are going to ask that too. Elijah was also translated. He was taken up. And Paul, what about him? He was taken to the third heaven. Or John, he was taken to heaven. John, who wrote the Gospel of John, was taken in the Spirit. And as Paul said, within the body or without the body, I cannot tell. But Enoch being translated has this idea of his body being changed or taken somewhere. And that's the point. He's been transported, taken. But it doesn't say where. It doesn't say he was, it says he was not. So he could have been taken to some other place, meaning another part of the world. Maybe in the part of the world where he was living, men sought to slay him like they sought to slay Abel. But God took him and took him to another place, and that he died there yet again. I mean, well, then he went and finally died and was buried. That he should not see death. He that believes, and you know, Jesus said, he that believes on me shall never see death. And the Pharisees said, you say that whoever believes in me shall never taste of death. But it also says that Christ himself tasted death for every man. There's a difference between seeing death and tasting death. I've talked about this before in other Bible studies. That the sight of death means to truly experience death as it really is. To see death is to die and to never rise again. Because that is what death is. It is that state of unending, eternal death. Whereas to die and be risen from the dead is to only taste death. It is not to truly see it. Jesus said we will never see death. And Enoch was not to see death. But it is given unto men, as Paul had said before, once to die. So there are several ways you could look at this, as I was saying before. You could look at it the way I just explained, that Enoch did indeed die. But as other men do, and he is like us, in that we shall never see death. But we will taste it, as Christ tasted it. Or you could look at it in the sense of, when John said, no man hath ascended to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, that he meant, other than the obvious examples of those who were taken there expressly. What he meant is that it is not the natural order of things for men to go to heaven. And that is another way you could look at it, that John was saying when he said, and I'm speaking of that, when he said no man hath ascended into heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man, which is in heaven, in the first chapters of John, John 3. Yes, John 3. When he said that he meant, except of course, Elijah, Enoch, and others who were taken up in special cases. Because if all men went to heaven, and here's another point I would like to make in regards to this. If everyone when they died went to heaven, you say, Paul, see, this proves what you say is wrong. Well, if everyone when they die goes to heaven, then there would be nothing special about Enoch. There would be nothing special about Elijah. Because we all would be translated at death and taken to heaven while our bodies remain and are buried. Whereas they are merely, their bodies are actually translated and they are taken to heaven, but they all end up in heaven in the same state. Which would mean that Enoch, Elijah, and such would no longer be exceptional if everyone else basically experienced the same thing. If they are all walking around in spirit bodies up in heaven now, as though they had already been raised from the dead, then there is nothing exceptional about Enoch or Elijah. So I think I've made that abundantly clear, that the exceptionalism, and also perhaps maybe are reading too much into it, one or the other. I mean, just because he was translated that he wouldn't see death doesn't mean that eventually he did not taste death like every man. And just because Jesus is the only one ascended into heaven, but he that came down, it does say no man. But sometimes those things are stated in a way which is, of course, excluding those few exceptions. That the general rule is no man. But I prefer to take it as no man. That Elijah and Enoch did not, though they were taken up, though they were translated, they did not remain there. But return to some other place and wait resurrection. And also they would use this in terms of Moses and Elijah appearing with Christ on the Mount of Transfiguration. I'm going to throw this in, because it's going through people's minds who disagree. Moses and Elijah appeared with Christ on the Mount of Transfiguration. Well, you know, it was also written in the time of Christ that many saints came out of their graves and were seen for several days after Jesus' resurrection as a sort of mini resurrection. That is exactly what I think was with Moses and Elijah. They were probably temporarily raised. They were temporarily raised from the dead and saw Christ. Or this is a very interesting idea that I've had. Perhaps when they were translated, they were brought to the future and met with Christ and then brought back. Now, each of those seems fantastical, but it is a fantastical idea that there even is a God. So all kinds of fantastical things are possible. I know when I talk about the serpent in the garden, people say, you actually believe a snake could talk? I'm like, well, the ass spoke to Balaam in the book of Numbers. There was a donkey who talked. Why not? Do you actually believe that the universe could spring from the Word of God or from a singularity or whatever? I mean, that's just as fantastical as the next. The fact that I'm sitting here is fantastical, though we do not think of it as so because it is so utterly common. Our own existence is so utterly common that we neglect and absolutely miss the fantastical fact that it even is. Without faith, we see in verse 6, it is impossible to please God. God cannot be pleased without faith. God does not like us not to have faith. He's determined that faith is so important that without faith, it is impossible to please him. Faith is so important. It is by faith that we obtain all the other promises of God. If you want to be righteous, if you want to walk uprightly, if you want to be virtuous, if you want to have true honor and glory and blessing in the Lord, then you will walk by faith. You will believe in the promises because faith is required. We got to go from faith to faith. You have to have faith to obtain temperance. You have faith to obtain righteousness. Faith is required for every aspect of our walk. Without faith, why? Because how do I know I'm going to be righteous tomorrow? By faith. Because I don't see tomorrow yet. You know, when I talk about the sins I've overcome, how do I know I'm not going to do it tomorrow? By faith. And it's not just, and it's a very strong persuasion within me. It isn't just like, well, I believe it and it's happening because I believe it. I'm believing it because God, I believe God has made it so. And he's already shown me from all those other days that he's caused me to walk for him. I know I have faith. Tomorrow will be like today. You know, gravity is still going to be operating. The Spirit of God is still going to be operating tomorrow, helping me forward, helping me win the race. That is faith. I believe that what he has brought me this far is not going to just abandon me tomorrow. Why would I believe that? That's lack of faith. That's what the problem was in the wilderness with the Israelites. You know, they God had brought them out by miracles and signs and wonders, but they lacked faith in what God would do tomorrow. It's not that they didn't believe what he had done. They believed it, but by what he had done, they were not persuaded. They did not have faith in what he was going to do in the future, or to just trust that whatever he would do in the future would be as good for them as what he had done in the past. And the reason they stumbled was because at present, things seemed fearful. And that is a temptation always for every person who has faith, that when today's circumstances look bleak, our faith begins to waver because we think, today is the day, maybe he's forsaking me, and tomorrow he'll be gone. But beloved, do not be so. Let us please God. Let us continue. Let's believe in God in spite of our circumstances, because that is the only thing that will help us out of our circumstances, is to continue to have faith in what he is going to do for us, and what he has promised to do for us. We must believe that he is. I believe in God. Thou doest well. The devils also believe and tremble. So, go from faith to faith. I believe in God. What God? Who God? What God? This God. You must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. That seek him using speed. Diligently seek these things. If these things be in you and abound, you know, you shall be neither barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of Jesus Christ. Wherefore, the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure. That's 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 10. Give diligence to make your calling and election sure. Diligently seek God. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. How do you seek it? By faith. How do you have faith? Well, I believe that God wants me to seek his kingdom, and that his kingdom is there for me to find. And my faith is that I shall find it, even though I don't see myself having found it yet. You know, all things are put under his feet, but we do not see all things put under his feet yet. All things are given to us, righteousness, holiness, perfection, right? But I don't see it yet. But yet, what do I have to prove that it's coming? All I have is my faith. My faith is the only proof. The only proof you have, absolute proof that that's going to fall, that the gravity is going to operate, is your own faith. And people say, well, that's not proof. And you're right. It isn't absolute proof. It is that persuasion from what you've already seen that something unseen is going to be. And it can't really be proven, but it's really the only proof you have. It's like, well, I think a trillion examples of gravity continuing to operate from day to day is enough for me to believe that it's going to operate tomorrow. Verse 7, by faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. Notice Noah. By faith, what did Noah do? By faith, Noah believed. By faith, Noah believed in belief and had faith in faith. And faith, no. By faith, Noah added faith to faith, and he moved. Faith moves you. If you believe the gravity is still operational, and you stand under a falling object, does it move you? Yes, sirree. Because you believe, well, gravity isn't going to stop operating right before it hits me in the head. So you move with fear. God, by telling Noah, the earth is going to be flooded, build me an ark, Noah moved with fear to do what God had directed him to do. Be ye holy as I am holy, saith the Lord. Let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God, said Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. And so what? When I hear that, I move with fear to obtain those promises, to be diligent, to use speed. God, give me the promise. God, make those things real to me. Make those things happen. Because some things are beyond our power. Some things, you know, we can pray and ask and seek. And in being diligent in seeking and in diligent in asking is the movement that is required. Or if there's an action required, to do the action told. Noah was warned of God, so he moved with fear. That was his faith. The moving was the demonstration. You know, show me your faith without your works. Noah believed God and did nothing. That's dead faith. Dead faith does nothing. Faith plus anything plus nothing equals dead. Faith plus nothing equals a dead faith. Like I can say, I believe this object is going to fall to the ground, but that's dead. That's worthless. You know, because it's 99.9% sure anyways. And even surer than that, right? So, a real faith is when you act on. So you say, I believe this is going to happen, so I. It is something worth acting on, something worth obtaining, something worth using diligence to obtain. Having faith merely in a fact of something, like I believe gravity is going to operate tomorrow. Dead. What is that? How does that change your life? I believe Jesus Christ is going to raise me from the dead and I need to be faithful to his doctrine. I need to be faithful to what he says that I need to become a son of God. I need to be diligent in pursuing those things. That should cause action. That is a living faith. Faith that causes us to act, to do, to move. And what did that faith do for Noah? It caused his whole house to be saved. And he condemned the world in his faith. Because his faith made a stark contrast with their lack of faith. He was the heir of the righteousness which is by faith. We know Noah got drunk afterwards, but that is not so much the point of like drunkenness and so on. What it is that portion, his faith, that example of faith is righteous. That is righteousness. And everything else God is going to judge. But we want to look at the examples of righteousness and faithfulness. Whatever happens afterwards to them is not so much what I'm concerned with. And Paul doesn't concern himself with it either. I never see anyone much concerning themselves with it, except for people who love scandalous stories, right? Verse 8, by faith Abraham, when he was called to go out to a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. Notice, by faith Abel offered, by faith Enoch was translated. By faith Noah moved. By faith Abraham, he obeyed. Notice that by faith, all these different actions are happening. Things are being given from man. God is giving things to man. Notice when Enoch had faith, he was translated. He didn't have faith to translate himself. Enoch had faith to be translated, and God translated him. So Abraham obeyed by faith. Faith brought about obedience. See, faith without some sort of work is a dead faith. Whether that work come about by the action of God, I mean, whether that action come about through the operation of God directly, or of what we do in response to what God has said by faith. So Abraham went out. He didn't know where he went. Verse 9, by faith he sojourned in the land of promise as a stranger. I'm sorry. Actually, that's what I have, as in a strange country, but literally as a stranger, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. They were heirs of a promise. God made a promise to Abraham, come out of your country and from your kindred, and come into the land I will show you. You know, and he's told, I will give this land to your descendants for an inheritance. And I will make them as innumerable as the stars of heaven and the sands of the sea. Verse 10. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He looked for something from God. He looked for something not from man or from the world that man had created, but he was following God and looking to what God would provide based on what God had promised. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Sarah received strength to conceive. She was well past the time of conception. Through faith, she judged God faithful. Even though for a time, but you look at though, she's judged faithful because she eventually did conceive. Even though for a moment, she gave Hagar to Abraham, here, lay with my maiden. Because when God made the promise, there was a delay. God promised, you will bear a son. And I suppose maybe a month or two might have gone by. I don't know off the top of my head, but some time went by. And Sarah began to worry. I haven't conceived yet. She probably expected when God said she would conceive that it would happen right away. And so she gave Abraham, her handmaiden, Hagar, and said, lay with her and that'll be the child. But then she did conceive eventually. And Paul says it was by faith. Because though she did what she did, she still believed that God would provide the seed. Somewhat doubted exactly how, and she tried to manipulate it. To me, that's like I believe God's going to deliver me. Let's say God's going to deliver me from a particular sin. And in the process of wanting to be delivered, I say to myself, well, I'm still drinking. Now, let's say it's alcoholism. I'm still a drunk, and I got to do something about this. God, I know God wants me to be righteous. I'll go to a 12-step program. 12-step programs are good. I mean, I'm glad men are trying to lay aside alcohol, right? But that is kind of like the Hagar solution. Hagar answers to the law, as according to Paul in Romans, right? She answers to the law, and it is the best in the face of such lack, such inability to fulfill the promise of God. Meaning, God promised Sarah, you're going to have a baby. And she physically can't do it. So she thinks there has to be a baby. So I will give my husband this other woman, and her son will become the child of promise. And so the same thing is like when we pursue deliverance from sin through channels other than through the miraculous and the Spirit of God, meaning the Spirit of God just gives it to me and writes it in my heart a change. What do? We go to 12-step programs and we try to change ourselves. And it isn't something God hates or anything. Because we're trying to be faithful to his promise. We're trying to see those things fulfilled. But we have to also know this, that to truly overcome it is not by the works of man, but by the works of God which happen inside of us, which are impossible for us to fake or to make happen by any means of our own doing. That's why Sarah was beyond the point of conception. Because God wanted that to show how that he would do things that it was impossible for a man to do or a man to force. Certainly at that time, I know they've had old women conceiving these days because, and I don't mean to say it old women like that, but I know they've had older women conceive these days by medical procedures and so on and so forth. But the point was that at that time it seemed impossible. She went to menopause, or whatever. She was well beyond the time of conception. And it was impossible. The only thing that seemed possible for man was, well, I'll go to Hagar. And that answers to like legalism. Thou shalt not kill. Well, I'll go and just remember to obey that. Whereas the righteousness which is of faith says, I come to do thy will, O God. That is the righteousness of faith. The righteousness of the faith is I better not do that because God will be displeased. Or I've got to manipulate circumstances so that it works out righteously. No, it is, I come to do thy will, O God. It is written in my heart to do thy will, O God. I am obedient by faith. He who promised was faithful. She believed that there was going to be that child of promise. Even when she gave Hagar, she believed there's going to be a child. And she thought maybe this is the way God meant. But then she became pregnant, right? And things changed. Verse 12. There sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. Those, of course, figures of speech. Meaning a lot of people. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promise, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims in the earth. Genesis 23. It's actually alluded to several times in the Old Testament. So all these lists, they died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. Meaning, Abraham never saw. And notice, oh, Lord, thank you. Verse 13, these all died in faith. Enoch died. Look at the context. These all died. Praise the Lord. I now know how to answer people when they tell me, what about Enoch? What about Elijah? Well, Elijah isn't listed here, but it's the same thing. Elijah was translated. Enoch was not for God. The Lord took him. He was translated. But he died. It says so here. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises. And Enoch's translation was the promise of resurrection, to be changed into a different body and to be brought up and taken away. At least that's the way it's generally thought of it, though, like it says, translated just means transported. It could just mean physically. It doesn't necessarily mean body transformation. It means body translation to a different place. But they did not receive the fullness of the... Like, Abraham went to the promised land and he died, but he never actually saw his heirs inherit it. And we don't know the extent of the promises, what it meant, the promise to Abel, the promise, you know, it's the promise of the forgiveness of sins, of the righteousness which is by faith. And Noah also died, not really receiving the fullness of the promise of the righteousness by faith, which would only be fulfilled in Christ. The same thing with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah. The promises, the fullness of the promises were not fulfilled until the coming of Christ and are not really realized till the consummation of the age and the resurrection of the dead. But they saw them afar off. They believed in what was future. They were persuaded, which is the word. It is a kindred word to the word faith. Faith is pythos, and this is, also pythio. And they were embraced. They embraced the promises. They were persuaded of them. They confessed. They made confession that they were strangers and pilgrims in the earth. They were something other. They sought something else. Verse 14. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of the country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country. That is, and heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. Abraham came and he says, I am a stranger in a strange land. But Paul is saying there's something philosophically more there. There's a greater wisdom in that. Not just that he was thinking of, oh, I used to live in the land of the Chaldees, but that there was something unsatisfactory about the human condition. There's something strange about it. Something unnatural about it. Something that is other to us than we think ought to be right. Something that we are looking for something better, something different, somewhere else. Something, I'm a stranger here where I live. I've lived here 10 years and I still feel like an outsider. When I was in school, I felt like an outsider. When I was among my friends, I felt like an outsider. I always feel like an outsider. It's one of my complaints of life. That is what people say and how people feel when they're seeking God. Because if you were to utterly feel at home at earth and utterly feel at one with the way things are and utterly feel comfortable in it, why would you seek anything better? You've found your place. My place is elsewhere. If you love the world, it's probably your home. But those who seek something else have a feeling of foreignness, of otherness, of a feeling that they want to move on, a feeling that they want to be elsewhere, to be other. And for them, he has prepared a city whose builder and maker is God. And so it is an heavenly city. As we read in Revelation, it's going to come down from heaven and occupy a place on the earth. And God is not ashamed to be called our God, because he called us forth from out of the world and into his light. He has prepared it for us. By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. according that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. A figure. You know, a shadow again. A similitude. The sacrifice of Isaac was a similitude of the sacrifice of Christ, bringing him to that point of where he was almost ready to kill him. But the God did not stay the hand that slew Christ, but rather allowed it to happen. But Isaac, in a figure of resurrection, got up off the altar, and instead the animal was placed in his place. But for Christ, there would be no substitute. He alone would bear the brunt of the pain and the death and the suffering, and he would die once for all. Verse 20, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. You know, Isaac blessed Esau and Jacob, giving them different blessings. He couldn't see. He touched, right? And he guessed who was who. But to say what was to come, he did it by faith. Even though there was trickery afoot. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed both of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. But when Jacob blessed them, he crossed his hands. Something his father couldn't do was to bless the younger over the older. But Jacob knew and crossed his... the father of the two sons of Joseph brought his two sons to Jacob with... The oldest one so he would be on Jacob's right, and the younger one so he would be on his left. And Jacob purposefully knew this, crossed his hands. And he couldn't see well either. But he saw something afar off, even more clearly than his own father had seen it. The blessings that would be. And passed on the promises. Verse 22. But notice there's all action. They bless. They do things by faith. By faith, Jacob, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. He was thinking ahead. Hundreds of years before they would actually leave, he said, take my bones with you. Take them out and let them not be buried in this heathen land, but bury them in the land of promise, the land that they had not even yet received, but that God had promised them for a possession. Verse 23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. They saw the promise in him. They saw he was a comely child. There was something good about him. There was something handsome about him, something which they thought they ought to preserve, knowing the king's commandment, that all should die, but they were not afraid. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. All the pleasures of the wealthy and all the things that they enjoy, it is the pleasure of sin that they enjoy while others suffer, while others are in pain, while others are in lack, others are in want. They enjoy their pleasures. And by faith, Moses saw something there that was worth staying away from. I will go and suffer. I would rather suffer with the weak than rejoice with the strong, because he believed God was the avenger of those who so suffer. Verse 26, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. That's what I was just saying. He was more mindful of what would happen. What would be the end of God for those who lived at the expense of others, for those who enjoyed things that were sinful, while others had nothing but barely that which they needed to survive? He'd rather suffer and bear reproach, because in this world, the weak and those who do not have are always reproached. People judge you. Even in our rich country, you know, you don't have a nice enough car, they look at you, they judge you. If you don't have enough money, they look at you, they judge you. The rich love to give to the rich. The rich go to rich churches and they give to the rich pastors and they all live in their rich neighborhoods. But God is going to destroy them all. And you say, well, Paul, how can you say that? By faith. I know. Woe to you, rich. What have you done with your riches? Ask yourself. Verse 27, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Through faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith, Moses left Egypt, and he endured, trusting in the righteousness of his cause, and that God would preserve him. Verse 28, through faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood. You know, they had to put the blood of the lamb on the doorpost so that the angel of death would pass over the house of the Hebrews. But over the house of Pharaoh and of all the Egyptians, the death angel came upon them and slew their firstborn. By faith they passed through the Red Sea, as by dry land, which the Egyptians essayed to do were drowned. They went forth to cross that sea and they were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down, and they were compassed about 7 days. By faith the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. I had a pastor once who went to great pains to try to explain that Rahab wasn't a harlot, because she died of, you know, she was a dyer of purple, and, you know, he was so, you know, so insistent on defending her character. But I don't find a problem with it. You know, but what? Is it, if she was a harlot, she wouldn't be worthy? You know, that being a merchant of purple would have made her more worthy of God's grace? She believed the Israelites would destroy the great city of Jericho, and so she helped them, and she hid the spies. She believed that God was going to deliver the city into their hands, and that in so doing, she would be spared. They thought their city would stand, but instead it collapsed. Verse 32, and what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, and of Barak, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in the dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. God having obtained some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. Without us, I mean, the whole number had to be brought in for this. You know, God is calling many sons to righteousness. He made the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. They suffered through things. They believed and they did not receive the promise. And we will suffer through things and we will not receive the promise until we all are brought in and all are made perfect. And the resurrection of the dead, they did not receive the promise. They did not raise from the dead. They are in their graves. They're waiting for the promise. That is the Christian truth. And there's so much falsehood out there that says, no, they're all in heaven. No, they all received all the promises. No, they did not. They died in faith, waiting for the promise. There's such confusion and such false doctrine and unsound practices in the church and speaking things that people want to hear and to tickle their itching ears. Oh, we want to hear. We want to think they're looking down to the portals in heaven, but they are not. They died in faith. They suffered many things. And until the full number be brought in, until the trumpet sound from heaven, and the dead rise, and those who are alive are changed, and the full number be brought in, they cannot be perfected without us. And we cannot be perfected without those that are yet to come. And back verse, Gideon. If you don't know Gideon, he was the one who came down. The Lord said he would deliver them by his hand. And he called together a few hundred people, and God kept reducing the numbers by these various arbitrary tests. You know, the man take with you people who only drink a certain way from the stream. You know, and they basically did a psychological warfare where they brought out these lamps and broke them and shouted, and the people panicked and they started killing each other and running, and the armies were driven away. And there's so much more to that story. I mean, Gideon was one of the examples of men who spoke with God and did not die because they spoke with the angel of the Lord, person of Christ in pre-incarnation, doubtless. And Barak, Deborah and Barak, these are from the books of Judges, and we're not going to cover the book of Judges in this series, and I'm not going to cover each of these in detail, but Samson, who, after the defeat, after the seduction of Delilah, the temptation, and the foolishness of revealing his secret, his hair was cut, and his eyes were put out, and his strength was taken from him, but then when his hair had grown back, he had faith to pray and say, God, give me strength that I may destroy these, and in my death, avenge my two eyes. And by faith, he put his hands on the pillars and brought the house down. Jephthah, another one of the judges of David and of Samuel. Oh, there's so much that could be said about all that. The prophets. I'm not going to go through every example. Paul isn't going to go through it. Those examples can be read. But in it, you can see it in the reading of faith. And that's the way you should read the Old Testament in light of the new, in a sense of looking for the faith and the promises. It is just numerous examples of how by faith people receive things. How God is pleased when we believe. I often say David was as unrighteous as Saul, but the way God looked at it was different because of his lack of faith. They subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, clothed the mouths of lions, the three Hebrew children in the fiery furnace. They quenched the violence of fire. They were thrown into the fiery furnace, I think, at that time. Escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weakness were made strong. I think of Jephthah, or I believe he was the man, or one of the judges. He was a left-handed man. And then in the book of Judges, there are these numerous weak things. I forgot if there are five or four. Some number of weak things. The jawbone, the new jawbone of a donkey, meaning it was still a soft, because bones become hard and brittle and they become good for weaponry after they dry out. But while they're yet wet, they're not as effective. So, the women receiving, in the days of Elijah and Elisha, the women receiving the dead raised to life again and being tortured, not accepting deliverance. We'll let you go. Just renounce the words that you have spoken in the name of the Lord. Just renounce. Just say to everyone right now that God has not spoken to you. Just tell everyone the truth. But they kept it up. To receive a better resurrection. When I rise, I'm going to rise better than I would have risen if I had not accepted this torture for the truth's sake. My resurrection will be better because of this. So they looked for the better resurrection rather than escaping pain at the moment. Not that it's wrong to ask God deliverance. But also, when you know it's sure, you submit yourself to it. And it's not an easy thing. But even Christ is our forerunner. He has done this. I think of him in the garden, that agony. And I would be shocked if I didn't experience the same agony going into something like that if I were to ever experience that, which my flesh revulses against, but my spirit is willing. I feel like I want to suffer for Christ because it will be so much better. But on the other hand, I think, gosh, suffering for Christ, wow, that could be really hard. It could be very painful. Am I really, really willing? Am I really, really able? But I trust God that he'll make me able to bear it. That's trusting in his promise. Being mocked and whipped and bonds, imprisonment, all the things. They were stoned, sawn asunder. I think that's, by tradition, Isaiah's fate was to be sawn in half. They were tempted. Even Christ was tempted, to abandon the truth, to, lay aside the righteousness of God and to take the easy path, take the path of wealth and of worldly renown and of worldly gain and pleasure. They went about and, you know, they didn't wear fine clothes like John the Baptist, the last prophet, you know. Last prophet of the old age, went around in his camel, I think it was a rough garment of camel hair. He didn't have any money for anything better. But the world was not worthy of all those who suffered. They wandered in caves and dens, and they obtained a good report through faith, God testifying of his pleasure in them. But they died, just like everyone else. They died. They all died. And they didn't receive the promise of resurrection. God did not receive them into his kingdom, into his heaven. It is still waiting. God having provided some better thing for us, that without us they should not be made perfect. And that's why it goes back to, you know, Acts chapter 2. David is not ascended to the heaven. His grave is with us. That's what Peter said. And the Apostle John saying that only Christ has risen. Only one man has entered into heaven. The rest are waiting. And if we see examples, there is another explanation. They're not coming down from heaven. They're coming up from the ground. They're coming from the past into the future. Transported, translated through time, through space. But they die and are buried. Or they die and are ripped apart. But God, the blood of them, it still calls. He knows where they are and from whence he shall raise them. If he made Adam from mud, it doesn't take much to raise a dead man for God. So this is even where our faith is. And that is the focus of this. You know what's the focus? It's faith for those things, but the real faith we need is faith for the resurrection from the dead. And as we go that way, we want to obtain all the promises of God for righteousness, as they also obtained. We want to obtain a good report, because when we die, that's all we will have, is that good report of our faith. We will not have, they won't say, "Well, Paul rose from the dead," because it's not yet seen. And when it's seen, that'll be the fulfillment of the promise. But for the others who do not believe, it will condemn them, and they will be condemned.